From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Haunting of Hinton Apner by Lord Halifax. The story itself is contained in a long statement by Mary Ricketts. This is preceded by some correspondence between her and her husband, Mr. William Henry Ricketts, who was away in Jamaica at the time, her brother John Jervis, agent to Lady Hillsborough, who was the owner of Hinton House, and others. For the most part, these letters are merely a repetition of Mrs. Ricketts' narrative. This is supposed to be a true ghost story. The mansion, house, and estate of Hinton Apner near Aylesford, Hampshire, devolved in 1755 to the Right Honorable Henry Bilson Legg and right of his lady, daughter, and sole heiress of Lord Stawell, who married the eldest daughter and co-heiress of Sir Hugh Stukely, by whose ancestors the estate of Hinton had been possessed many generations, and by this marriage passed to Mr. Stawell on the death of the said Sir Hugh. On the evening of April 2nd, 1755, Lord Stawell, sitting alone in the little parlor at Hinton, was seized with a fit of apoplexy. He articulated only one sentence that could not be understood and continued speechless and insensible till the next morning when he expired. His household at that time consisted of the following: Isaac Mackerel, house steward and bailiff; Sarah Parfait, housekeeper, who had lived in the family near 40 years; Thomas Parfait, coachman, husband to Sarah; Elizabeth Banks, housemaid, an old family servant; Jane Davis, dairymaid; and Mary Barris, cook; Joseph Sibley, butler; Joseph Groom, Richard Tanner, gardener; and so continued by Mr. Ricketts. Lord Stawell had one son who died at Westminster School, aged 16. Thomas Parfait, his wife, and Elizabeth Banks continued to have the care of the house during the lifetime of Mr. Legg, who usually came there for 1 month every year in the shooting season. On his death in August of 1764, Lady Stawell, so created in her own right and since married to the Earl of Hillsborough, determined to let Hinton Mansion, and Mr. Ricketts took it in December following. Thomas Parfait was at that time lying dead in the house, and his widow and Elizabeth Banks quitted it on our taking possession in January 1765. We removed thither from town and had the same domestics that lived with us there, nor till sometime afterwards had we any house servant belonging to the neighborhood. We had not long been settled at Hinton, when I began frequently to hear noises in the night, as of people shutting, or rather, slamming doors. Mr. Ricketts often went round the house, supposing that someone had broken in, or that there was some irregularity among the servants. In these searches, he never could trace any person. He found the servants in their proper apartments and no appearance of disorder. The noises continued to be heard, and I could conceive no other cause then that some of the villagers had false keys to let themselves in and out at pleasure. The only remedy was to change the lock, which was accordingly done, yet without the effect we had reasonably expected. About 6 months after we came, Elizabeth Brailsford, nurse to our eldest son Henry, then about 8 months old, was sitting by him as he slept in the room over the pantry, used as the nursery. Since it was a hot summer's evening, she had opened the door facing the entrance into the yellow bedchamber, which, with the adjoining dressing room, was the apartment usually occupied by the lady of the house. She was sitting directly opposite to this door, and plainly saw, as she afterwards related, a gentleman in a drab-colored suit of clothes go into the yellow room. She was in no way surprised at the time, but on the housemaid, Molly Newman, coming up with her supper, she asked what strange gentleman had arrived. Upon the other answering there was no one, she related what had been already described and desired her fellow servants to accompany her and search the room. This they did immediately without finding any trace of what she had seen. See, she was much concerned and disturbed, yet sure she could no ways be deceived, the light being sufficient to distinguish any object clearly. When some time afterward her story was mentioned to me, I treated it as the effect of fear or superstition, to which the lower class of people are so prone, and it was entirely obliterated from my mind till the late astonishing disturbances brought to my recollection this and other previous events. In the autumn of the same year, George Turner, son of the gardener who was then groom, crossing the great hall to go to bed, saw at the other end a man in a drab-colored coat. He concluded that he was the butler who, being lately come and his livery not made, wore such a colored clothes. But as he passed upstairs to the room where all the men-servants lay, he was astonished to find the butler and all the others in bed. Thus the person he had seen in the hall, like the person before described by the nurse, remained unaccounted for. George Turner, now living, avers these particulars in the same manner as he first related them. In the month of July 1767, about 7 in the evening, there was sitting in the kitchen Thomas Wheeler, postillion, Ann Hall, my own woman, Sarah, a waiting woman to Mrs. Mary Points, and Dame Lacey. The other servants were out, excepting the cook, who was washing up her things in the scullery. The persons in the kitchen heard a woman come downstairs and along the passage leading towards them. Her clothes rustled as though they were of the stiffest silk. The door was open, and on their looking towards it, they saw the figure of a woman pass swiftly by, and, as they thought, out of the house door. Their view of her was imperfect, but they plainly distinguished a tall figure in dark-colored clothes. Dame Brown, the cook who came in at this moment, saw the figure pass close by her, and then disappear. She described the person and drapery, as before mentioned, and while they were all discussing the appearance, a man arrived through the yard and up to the house by the way the woman had gone out. On being asked, he declared that he had seen no one. Meanwhile, the noises continued to be heard occasionally. Miss Parker's woman, Susan Maidstone, was terrified by the most dismal groans and rustling round her bed, and at different times most of the servants were alarmed by unaccountable noises. In the latter end of the year 1769, Mr. Ricketts went to Jamaica, while I continued at Hinton with my three infant children and eight servants. These latter, with the exception of the butler, who was a Swiss, were ignorant country people. Some time after Mr. Ricketts left me, I then, sleeping in the bedroom over the kitchen, frequently heard the noises of someone walking in the room within, the rustling as of silk cloths against the door opening into my room was sometimes so loud and so continuous as to break my rest. Although we often made instant search, we never could discover any appearance of human or brute being. Repeatedly disturbed in this manner, I made it my constant practice to search the room and closets within, and to secure the only door that led from that room on the inside in such a manner as to be certain no one could gain entrance without passing through my own apartment, which was always made fast by a bolt on the door. Yet in spite of these precautions, the disturbances continued with little interruption. About this time, an old man living in the poorhouse at West Meon came and desired to speak to me. When admitted, he told me he could not rest in his mind without acquainting me with a story his wife had often related to him. In her younger days, a carpenter whom she had known well had told her that he was once sent for by Sir Hugh Stukely and directed by him to take up some boards in the dining room, known in our time as the lobby. The carpenter believed that Sir Hugh had hidden something which he conceived to be treasure underneath. Later he was ordered to put down the boards in the same manner as they had been before. I repeated the story to Mr. Sainsbury, attorney to Lady Hillsborough, suggesting to him that he might have the floor taken up and examined. In February 1770, two of my servants left and were replaced. A little later, my butler also went away, and I hired another man to succeed him. During the 7 years that I was at Hinton, I had many changes of servants, so that at the time of my leaving, not one of those who had accompanied me there was still in my service. I mention this fact to show the improbability of a conspiracy among them. In the summer of 1770, when I was lying one night in the yellow bedchamber, I plainly heard the footsteps of a man walking towards the foot of my bed. I thought the danger too near for it to be of any use to ring my bell for assistance, but sprang out of bed in an instant and fled into the nursery opposite. I returned with the nursemaid and a light to make a search in my bedchamber, but found nothing. There was a light burning in the dressing room within as usual, and there was no way out other than through the door that opened to the nursery. At the time when I heard the footsteps, I was perfectly awake and collected. For some months afterwards, I did not hear any noises that particularly struck my attention until in November of that same year, when I was sleeping in the chintz bedroom over the hall. I once or twice heard noises of music, and on one night in particular, three distinct and violent knocks, as though someone were beating with a club or other heavy weapon against a door downstairs. I thought that housebreakers must be forcing their way in, and immediately rang my bell. No one answered it, but as the noise ceased, I thought no further of it at the time. After this, and in the beginning of the year 1771, I was frequently conscious of a hollow murmuring which seemed to fill the whole house. It was like no other sound that I have heard and could not have been caused by the wind, as it occurred even on the calmest nights. On the morning of the 27th of February, when Elizabeth Godin, my woman, came into my room, I inquired of her about the weather. Noticing that she replied in a very faint voice, I asked her if she were ill. She said she was well, but had never been so terrified as during the preceding night. She had heard the most dismal groans round her bed, and when she got up to search the room and look up the chimney, she could discover nothing, though there was bright moonlight. I did not pay much attention to her account, but it occurred to me that she would be afraid to sleep in the room again if anyone should tell her that it was the one formerly occupied by Mrs. Parfait, the old housekeeper, who had died a few days before at Kilmston and had been buried in Hinton churchyard that very evening. 5 weeks later, On the 2nd April, I awoke between 1 and 2 o'clock. As I found by my watch, which was on a table close by my bedside, I lay thoroughly awake for some time, and then heard footsteps going to and fro in the adjoining lobby. I got out of bed and listened at the door for the pace of 20 minutes, during which I distinctly heard the walking and, in addition, a loud noise as though someone were pushing strongly against the door. Being sure that I was not deceived, I determined to ring my bell, which I had not done before because I did not wish to disturb the nursery maid, who was very ill of a fever. My woman, Elizabeth Godin, was sleeping in the room with my sons and came immediately on hearing my bell. Convinced that there were persons in the lobby, I asked her before I opened my door if she saw anyone. On her replying that she did not, I went out to her, examined the window, which was shut, and looked under the couch, which was the only piece of furniture which might conceal anyone. I further found that the chimney board was fastened, and when I removed it, there was nothing behind it. The door into the lobby was shut, as it was every night. After completing this examination, I was standing in the middle of the room, wondering what could have caused the noise, when suddenly the door that opened into the little recess leading to the yellow room sounded as if it were being swung to and fro by someone standing behind it. This was more than I could bear, and I ran into the nursery and rang the bell to the men's apartments. The coachman, Robert Camus, came to the door at the top of the landing, which was secured every night so that no one could get to that floor except through the windows. Upon opening it to him, I told him that I had reason to suppose that someone was behind the door leading to the yellow room. He took a light and armed himself with a billet of wood, while Elizabeth Godin and I stayed behind. When he opened the door, he found no one. The yellow room was locked, the key was hanging up, and a great bolt was drawn across the outside door. After Robert had again secured the door and returned to his apartments, I went and lay down in my son's room. About half an hour afterwards, I heard 3 distinct knocks. They seemed to come from below, but I could not then or later discover the exact spot. Next night, I returned to my own room, where I heard noises now and then, and frequently the hollow murmur which I have described. On the 7th of May, this murmur was uncommonly loud. I could not sleep, apprehending it to be the prelude to some greater noise. At last I got up and went to the nursery, where I stayed till 3:30, and then, it being daybreak, I returned to my own apartment to try to get some sleep. I lay there till 4:10, when the great hall door directly under me was slammed to with the utmost violence, so that my room shook perceptibly. I jumped out of bed and ran to the window overlooking the porch. There was plenty of light, but I could see nothing to account for what I had heard. The front door, when I examined it, was fast locked and bolted as usual. From this time, I determined to have my woman in a little bed in my room. The noises grew more frequent, and she always heard them just as I did. I was still very unwilling to report these occurrences. Although I had taken every means of investigating them, I could not discover the least appearance of a trick. On the contrary, I was convinced that the noises were beyond the power of any mortal agent. Still, knowing how exploded such opinions were, I kept them in my own bosom. After midsummer, the noises became more intolerable every night. They began before I went to bed and continued with intervals till it was broad daylight. Frequently, I could distinguish articulate sounds. Usually, a shrill female voice would begin talking, and presently 2 other voices, deeper and manlike, joined. in. But though the conversation sounded as if it were quite close to me, I never could distinguish any words. One night in particular, my bed curtains rustled as though someone were rushing by them. I asked Elizabeth Godin if she had heard anything, and she reported exactly the same sensation. Several times I heard sounds of music within the rooms, not regular or distinct notes, but a kind of vibration. And every night the walking, talking, knocking, opening, and slamming of doors were repeated. My brother, who had returned not long before from the Mediterranean, came to stay with me. Yet so improbable was my story that I could not bring myself to disclose it even to him. One morning, however, I carelessly said, "I was afraid the servants would disturb you last night," and rang my bell to order them to bed. He replied that he had not heard them. Next morning, about 3 o'clock, after he had left me to return to Portsmouth, Elizabeth Godin and I were both awake in the bed. She had been sitting up, looking round her, expecting, as she always did, to see something terrible. Suddenly, to my astonishment, I heard a most loud, deep, and tremendous noise, which seemed to rush and fall with great velocity and force on the lobby floor. She made no reply, but on my repeating the question, she answered in a faltering voice that she was so frightened she scarcely dared to speak. At that instant we heard a shrill and dreadful shriek, apparently proceeding from under the spot from which the rushing noise had come. It was repeated 3 or 4 times, growing fainter as it seemed to descend, until it sank into the earth. Hannah Streeter, who was sleeping in the room with my children, heard the same noises, which so appalled her that she lay for 2 hours, almost deprived of sense and motion. Having heard little of the earlier noises, she had rashly expressed a wish to hear more, and from that moment until she quitted the house, there was scarcely a night when she did not hear the sound of someone walking towards her door and pushing against it as though attempting to force it open. So dreadful was this last experience that I determined to unburden myself of the whole story to my brother on his return to Hinton. The frequency of the noises, the disturbance to my rest, and the necessity of often getting caught up at unreasonable hours gave me a fever and a deep cough. But though my health was much impaired, my resolution remained firm. While I was waiting for my brother's arrival, which was delayed through his being detained at Portsmouth a week longer than he had foreseen, it occurred to me to endeavor, by changing my apartment, to obtain a little rest. Accordingly, I moved to the room formerly occupied by Elizabeth Godin. I did not mention my intention of doing so until 10 at night, when the room was got ready for me. I went to bed and had scarcely lain down when the same noises that I have described began again. I mentioned the circumstance that I had changed my room without previous notice to prove how impossible it would have been for the plan to be suddenly conveyed by any human agent to another part of the house. In the following week, my brother arrived. Anxious though I was to tell him my story, I forbore until the next morning, wishing him to enjoy a night's rest. I had told him, however, that he must be prepared to hear on the morrow the most astonishing tale, which would demand all his trust in my veracity. In the morning I began my story, to which he listened with wonder and surprise. Just as I was finishing, Captain Luttrell, our neighbor at Kilmston, chanced to call and induced my brother to impart the whole story to him. He then, in a very friendly manner, offered to join in our investigations. We agreed that he should come late in the evening and divide the night watch with my brother, keeping their intention profoundly secret. During the daytime, my brother, accompanied by his servant John Bolton, made a thorough search of the whole house, and particularly of the rooms on the first floor and the attics. They examined every possible hiding place and saw that every door was fastened, except those leading to the rooms occupied by the family. That night, he went to bed in the room over the servants' hall. Captain Luttrell and Bolton sat up, with arms, in the chintz room adjoining. I was sleeping in Elizabeth Godin's room, and the children were in the nursery, so that every chamber on that floor was occupied. I bolted and locked the door leading from the back stairs, so that there was no entrance except through the room in which Captain Luttrell was keeping watch. As soon as I had lain down, I heard a rustling, as though someone were close to the door. I told Elizabeth Godin to listen, and if the noise continued, to go and tell Captain Luttrell. She did so, and instantly he threw open his door and spoke to us. I must now give his account, as he related it to my brother and myself next morning. He declared that he had heard the footsteps of a person walking across the lobby. He had instantly thrown the door open and called out, "Who goes there?" Something flitted past him, and my brother cried, "Look against the door." My brother was awake and had heard Captain Luttrell's challenge, as well as the noise. He rose and joined the other. To their astonishment, they continued to hear various noises, but although they examined everything everywhere, they could see nothing and found the staircase door fast secure as I had left it. My brother and Bolton then went upstairs, where they found the servants in their rooms and all the doors closed. All three men sat up together until daybreak, when my brother returned to his own room. About that time, as I imagined, I heard the chintz room door opened and slammed to with the utmost violence, and a moment later the hall door opened and shut in the same manner. I thought that my brother must have done this, and mentioned to Godin, to my surprise, that he, who was so attentive not to alarm or disturb the children, should behave so noisily. An hour later the front door again opened and slammed in the same way, so as to shake the house. No one was yet up, but about half an hour afterwards I heard the servants rise and go downstairs. At breakfast I remarked upon the noise my brother had made with the door. Mr. Luttrell replied, "I assure you Jervis made not the least noise. It was your door and the next which I heard opened and slammed in the way you described." My brother had not heard any of the doors open or shut, but told me that when he had gone to bed, and Captain Luttrell and I sitting below, he had heard the dreadful groans and various noises for which he was unable to account. His servant was at that time below with his staff. Captain Luttrell insisted that the disturbances of the night were such as to make the house an unfit residence for any human being. My brother, although more guarded in his language, agreed, and we decided to send an express to Mr. Sainsbury, Lady Hillsborough's steward, asking him to come over immediately on an urgent matter, with the nature of which he would be made acquainted on arrival. Unluckily, Mr. Sainsbury was confined with the gout, and sent over his clerk, a youth of 15, to whom we thought it useless and improper to divulge the circumstances. My brother sat up every night during the week he spent at Hinton. In the middle of one of them, I was alarmed by the sound of a gun or pistol discharged quite close to me, and immediately followed by groans as if a person in agony or on the point of death. These noises seemed to come from somewhere between my chamber and the next one, which was the nursery. I sent Godin to Nurse Horner to ask her if she had been disturbed, but she had heard nothing. Nor, I discovered next morning, had my brother. There were, however, several occasions when loud noises were heard by one or two people, whereas others equally near to the spot whence the sounds appeared to come were unaware of anything. Since the night watch deprived my brother of his sleep, he usually lay down after dinner. once when he had retired in this way to rest. I sent the children and their attendants out for a walk. The dairymaid had gone to milk, the cook was in the scullery, and my own woman, with my brother's man, was sitting in the servants' hall. I was reading in the parlor when I heard my brother's bell ring very sharply. I ran up to his room, and he asked me if I had heard any noise. Because, he said, as I was lying awake, an immense weight seemed to fall from the ceiling to the floor just by that mahogany press, and it is impossible that I should be deceived. By this time, his man had arrived and protested that he had heard nothing, although he had been in the room below. My brother now earnestly begged me to leave the house, offering, if I were unable to move before he had to return to Portsmouth, to send his lieutenant of marine, Mr. Nichols, who was an old friend of the family, to stay with me until I was ready to go. One circumstance was so striking that I must not omit to relate it. We were discussing the disturbances one evening when I mentioned the extraordinary effect they had had upon a favorite cat which was usually in the parlor with me. I had observed that she would sit for a while on a table or a chair with her accustomed unconcern and then suddenly would crouch, as though struck with the greatest terror, hide herself under my chair, and put her head close to my feet. After a while, she would come out quite unconcerned. Not long after I had told my brother about the cat, my story was verified in a striking manner. Nothing happened that might alarm the animal, but she behaved exactly as I have described. My servants told me that a spaniel in the house had been similarly affected, but that is only hearsay. The following is the story, or perhaps better said, the backstory, as to who might possibly haunt the Hinton Abner House. The Stukeley family had owned the house since the end of the 16th century, and by the mid-18th century it was in the possession of Edward Lord Stawell, who had married Mary Stukeley, a woman 10 years his senior. When Mary died in 1740, Edward took up with her much younger sister, Honoria, and local hearsay was rife that they had had a child, although the infant mysteriously disappeared soon after birth. Whatever the child's fate, Lord Stawell was widely regarded in the district as a notorious evil liver, and when his mistress died in 1754, the gossips considered her death retribution for the wicked and debauched going-ons to which she had been privy. Their suspicions seemed well-founded, when a year later Lord Stawell himself died from a sudden fit of apoplexy in the parlor of Hinton Abner House. Over the next 10 years, the house acquired a sinister reputation. Locals whispered in hushed tones of strange sounds heard echoing from within its walls in the dead of night, and of the figure of a gentleman in a drab-colored coat, who was seen standing in the moonlight, his hands behind him in the manner favored by the late Lord Stawell. By the end of the decade, it was well known that the house was haunted and locals shunned it at night, while servants often left after a short period, citing the ghostly going on as the reason. Unperturbed by its reputation, this was when Mr. and Mrs. Ricketts rented the house in 1764 and set about turning it into a respectable family home. It was during this time that Mrs. Ricketts lived there approximately 7 years, part of the time Mr. Ricketts was not there, as he had left for Jamaica, as he had related. As indicated towards the end of her story, she moved out. After that, a Mr. Lawrence took over the tenancy, but he suddenly quit his occupation and after that the house was left empty until in 1797 it was pulled down. No sooner had workmen commenced the demolition than under the floor of the lobby they uncovered a box containing a pile of bones and what, according to some witnesses, appeared to be the skull of a baby. Unfortunately, no professional opinions were sought as to whether or not these could be the remains of the infant whom the local gossips had long maintained was the fruit of Lord Stawell's illicit union with his sister-in-law, Honoria. The house was rebuilt 50 yards from where it originally stood.